everyone, and welcome to the Herping Hour podcast, episode 4. It's a very exciting one. We've got Beardy Origins today, and I don't know about anyone else, but I'm very excited to learn a lot today from good old Stacey.
Me too.
She's got some very cool stuff to talk about today, so super excited. No guest, it is just us this time. We did have some previously amazing guests. I think we have a guest on next week, don't we?
Yeah.
Yes. Oh, we have a very exciting guest next week. But just us three amazing people. And Stacey, take it away.
Thank you. So on this week's episode, we'll be covering a little bit of history, some husbandry / care information, including the importance of the third eye in regulating the circadian rhythm. We'll also be covering a section on morphs and genetics, and a short section around the most common illnesses and some tips to help you whilst you're waiting for a veterinary appointment. Just as a little brief bit of history, the bulk of captive bred bearded dragons today are thought to have originated from stock which was illegally exported from Australia during the 1970s. Many people believe that bearded dragons came from dinosaurs, but they're in fact a lizard, so they're classified separately. And they're part of a group called Lepidosauria, however you pronounce it. I know everyone's got different ways.
Yeah.
And it's a reptilian subgroup that also includes snakes and the now extinct mosasaurs. So reptiles in that group are actually categorised by having like overlapping scales. And that group has been around for about 240 million years since the mid-Triassic period. So they did coexist alongside the dinosaurs. But dinosaurs are actually part of a group called Archaeosauria, which is completely separate from the subgroup Lepidosauria. So that group includes dinosaurs and, by extension, birds, crocodilians, and pterosaurs. So creatures in that group have a wider assortment of like skin plate types, including scutes. So they're like the crocodilian and the legs of birds, you know, that kind of thing. And the two groups split off from each other during the Triassic period. So they produced the various reptile families, which have been, well, basically the Archaeosauria and the Lepidosauria. But lizards and dinosaurs did grow up together, and obviously they do today, but in the form of modern lizards and birds. So, But it is quite interesting because a lot of the time people thought that dinosaurs are reptiles, but only birds are direct descendants of dinosaurs. So birds are considered to be present day dinosaurs. Bearded dragons are actually a direct descendant of earlier reptile lizards, but not dinosaurs.
See, this is why bearded dragons are cool.
Yeah, they are quite cool. I'm going to go on to the husbandry and care side of things. I decided to make quite an in-depth care sheet, really, on, well, general stuff on how to care for dragons, but also a more in-depth look at UVB and how to get your vivarium set up to what I would consider a high standard, well, an advanced standard of care, really. So we all know that bearded dragons are one of the most commonly kept animals in captivity. The main bearded dragon that is kept in captivity is the central bearded dragon, so that's the Pogona vetiseps. They actually originate in Australia, and they do tend to span the majority of the country in warmer areas, you know, such as deserts and woodlands and savannas and scrublands, that kind of areas. So a warm habitat is crucial for them in captivity. They are cold-blooded and they rely on external heat sources to raise their body temperature. So contrary to popular belief, because I know that a lot of people believe that they don't need as much climbing enrichment and that type of thing, they're actually semi-arboreal and they do like to climb and spend the time between branches and rocks on the ground. So it's better to have both in the vivarium, and that's why I decided to do an image that would sort of depict what I would put in my vivarium. Also, they do tend to come out more in the early morning and the later afternoon sun, and they spend most of the time hiding away throughout the hottest parts of the day. But originally, it was well documented that they like to come out in the heat of the day, when actually it's now been more recently documented that they don't. They come out in the morning and the late afternoon, which makes a lot of sense, really, because when I've observed my own dragons, they do tend to come out first thing in the morning as soon as the lights come on and the heat's up to temperature. They tend to go out there for, I'd say, around 30 minutes. Then they retreat back to the cooler end of the vivarium and spend most of the day there until later on in the evening. So I would say that that is definitely the case, or would definitely be the case in the wild. So there's actually 7 different species of Pagona. They all have a difference in appearance. I can't really show that on the audio, but what I will do is I will put the image on the video which covers for the YouTube, and also it's in the cur guide that I've created just to show an example of, you know, the different looks that you get across the dragon species. So there's the Pagona veticeps, which is also known as the central bearded dragon, which is what we keep. There's the Pagona Henry Lassoni, which is also known as the Rankin's dragon. There's the Pagona Barbata, which is also known as the Eastern Bearded Dragon. The Pagona Minor, which is something I'd really like to keep, that's known as the Western Bearded Dragon. There's the Pagona Microlepidota, which is also known as Kimberley's Bearded Dragon. The Pagona Michelli, which is the Northwest Bearded Dragon. And there's the Pagona Nullarbor, which is also known as the Nullarbor Bearded Dragon. It's interesting, actually, because the Barbata Eastern Dragon, that's got more of a triangular head shape, actually. And the veticeps has got more of a rounded triangular head shape, which I'll show on the image that I put on the screen. The Pagona Minor, obviously, that's one of the small ones. Its head, it's almost the same shape, but it's interesting because the eyes on the Pagona Minor are wider. So the front of the skull is wider on a Pagona Minor than it is on a central or an eastern bearded dragon. But the back of the head, where the spikes are and their ears are, is actually thinner. So it's quite interesting, actually, how different they are, really. That was just a little bit of information around what types there are and, you know, where they come from.
I had no idea there was that many.
Yeah, they're all, well, I just say agamids, but they're called agamidae, aren't they? But they're all agamids, but they're all their own species. The scientific name is Pagona, but then each species has its own, you know, it's the subspecies, which are Pagona veticeps, Pagona Barbata, that kind of thing.
Barbatas have a very nasty attitude. Like, they're known to be, like, overly aggressive.
They are as a
species. They're very aggressive.
Really? Man. I had no idea. I think 3 of those I'd heard of. The rest, no idea. So that was very interesting for me.
Let's talk about housing.
Mm.
We recommend a wooden vivarium, which is a minimum of 4 foot long by 2 foot wide by 2 foot tall. So the reason that we recommend a wooden vivarium over a glass vivarium is because the wood holds the heat better. And for that reason, I don't generally suggest glass vivariums to anyone that I give a dragon to. So although glass vivariums can be adapted, it's more difficult to get the right gradients in those than it is in a wooden vivarium. It also takes less time to set up, especially for a new, you know, like a beginner.
For, say, like a pet keeper.
Yeah, for a pet keeper, or just anyone that hasn't kept beforehand. So it's easier to set up a wooden vivarium than it is to set up a glass vivarium. But yeah, a minimum of 4 foot, we would recommend. Anything bigger is obviously better because they get more floor space to run around. So with regards to bulbs, there's 2 types of bulbs that are needed in a vivarium. So the first one would be a basking bulb. And with regards to the basking bulb, depending on the size of the enclosure, you'd need between a 75 and 150 watt bulb usually, with the 150 watt being for the above minimum size vivariums. A satisfactory basking temperature is required and needs to be maintained between 105 to 110 Fahrenheit. I found that that's the best temperature, even for adults, really. I know that some people suggest lowering it down to between 95 and 100 for adults, but we keep ours at around 39 to 40 centigrade, we keep ours at. And they all seem to thrive, so that's what I would recommend. So to get the basking spot temperature as near to perfect as you need it to be, We'd recommend starting with a lower wattage bulb on a dimming thermostat and moving it up if necessary. And this is due to external factors, you know, such as vivarium size and room temperatures, especially. If a reptile room's involved, then obviously it can be warmer than average, and that's why we'd suggest starting off with a lower bulb to find the happy medium.
For you as a keeper.
Find the right temperature gradient type of thing, or find the right basking temperature.
Because you also have to take into account.
Yeah. Just because a really strong bulb works for someone else doesn't mean that really strong bulb is going to work for you if you've got, like you said, reptile room, other factors, things like that.
When you've got a strong bulb and you've got multiple reptiles using a strong bulb, it then ups the temp of the cool end. And then obviously that makes them uncomfortable because they've got no way to escape, really.
Mm.
So,
Dragons also need a good temperature gradient. So with this in mind, the opposite end of the vivarium should sit at around 80 Fahrenheit, usually. I would suggest that once the bulb's in place, that you monitor the dragon once everything's set up. And it's because, and I'll always say it, I've said it before, one size doesn't fit all. They're all different. Some prefer it warmer, some prefer it cooler, and I still stick by that. So I would say monitor your dragon once you're starting out on getting the basking temperature correct. And like I said, some dragons may struggle with higher basking temps. And to see that, they would likely hide away mostly from the area, which would suggest trying a small reduction in heat until you notice that your dragon is basking at more points during early morning and later afternoon. The same goes for if the dragon is the opposite and basks more than what they should. So I'd say basks more throughout the day rather than the generalized time of early morning and later afternoon. If that's the case and that's what you're seeing, then I would suggest upping the temperature slightly. I always say I recommend a 1 degree increment either way. So whichever behavior your dragon seems to be displaying, I would either increment it by 1 degree or decrease it by 1 degree to see if it helps to regulate the basking time that your dragon's having. That would give you an indication of whether everything's okay or not. And we also recommend either incandescent bulbs or halogen bulbs. You can still use basking bulbs, but we find that the incandescent and halogen bulbs are better for mimicking the natural sunlight. And that's the reason why we tend to use more of those than the basking bulb, if you can get hold of them. I've noticed that sometimes they're quite low in stock in many places. I mean, Arcadia do still do their own brand of halogen bulb. And we've used those as well, haven't we? We've not had a problem with them. You can use the incandescent bulbs as well. So the other advice that I would give when setting up a basking area, or to be honest, even an ambient temperature area, is you need it checking and you need it to be accurate. So my advice would be to get a decent heat gun, which is the infrared temperature guns. They will allow you to get an accurate reading. The one thing I would say is don't fire it through the glass because it's wholly inaccurate. Always open the glass to take the temperature reading. When doing temperature readings, I recommend doing the cool end, the middle, which is the ambient, and the hot end, so that you know that your gradient's working for you. The second bulb required in a vivarium with a dragon is a UV bulb, also known scientifically as shortwave ultraviolet B. So sunlight is made up of two different rays. There's the long-wave ultraviolet A and the short-wave ultraviolet B. So reptiles do need an element of both. Well, basking reptiles need an element of both, which they do get from both the basking bulb and the UVB bulb. So you get your UVA from your heat bulb. With the UV bulbs, you do need it to be spanning a quarter to a half of the vivarium, but no more than that. I'd usually say to go with half for a bigger vivarium, such as a 5-foot vivarium. If it's a 4-foot vivarium, we do recommend a quarter, which is usually a 22-inch kit. So if you're using a T8 bulb, you'd need it to span 3/4 of the vivarium. And the reason for this is because it isn't as powerful as the T5 high output bulbs. So if you're going to be using a T8 bulb, I'd recommend a 12% Arcadia T8 bulb rather than a 10% for a bearded dragon. Usually, we'd recommend between a 6% and a 12% high output T5 bulb. So that would be either the Arcadia 6% or the Arcadia 12%, depending on the level of climbing enrichment and basking platform height. We actually prefer to use the 6% T5 bulbs at a distance of roughly 9 to 10 inches away from the back of the dragon. We have tested this method with a Solometer 6.5R in a 4x2x2 vivarium setting. The UVI index is between 4 and 5.6 UVI, which is actually the perfect zone for bearded dragons. In Reptile Lighting Group on Facebook, they recommend between 3 and 5 UVI, which is ample for a bearded dragon, with 7 being the very highest, but not recommended due to the variety of morphs that are now available. So a normal scale, normal bearded dragon would probably be able to manage up to the 7%, whereas some of the newer morphs that lack melatonin and that kind of thing, they might not be able to withstand a UVI of 7 for as long as a normal bearded dragon would. And for that reason, between 3 and 5 is usually ample. So our actual basking area with a 6% bulb is reading at 5.2 UVI. With a 12% bulb, it's reading around 4.5 because of the lack of height to the basking area that we've had to use. So that's why we do recommend a 6% bulb, because you can give your dragon more of a basking area and still have ample distance between the dragon and the UV so as not to cause any issues with eyesight or anything like that. So I have put some information on the distance of UVB depending on enclosure size in the new cur sheet that I'm going to be putting up on our group, Reptile Intelligence UK. I'll just talk you through a little bit of it. So if you're going to be using a 6% UVB, then the reptile lamp should be positioned between 15 and 20 centimetres above your reptile's head. This will give them a good dose wherever they roam. I've highlighted the one that we use, and it must overlap the basking area. That's the key element here. And also, so as not to confuse between 6 and 12% bulbs, it is between 15 and 20 centimetres, whereas with the 12%, it's between 15 and 20 inches. So we do recommend the 22-inch kit. The Pro T5 kits are better because they come as an all-in-one unit, so you can literally just plug in power supply and off you go, put your lamp in, and that's that. You can get the other types, which you manually attach to either end and put that in. They work fine too, but for ease, you get your bulb in with the kit and you can just sort of plug and play, really. As I said, with a 12% UV, if you want to go down that route, you'd need it to be positioned between 15 and 20 inches above the reptile's head to maximise the scope of the lamp. I've also put in a diagram, which I'll flash up now on the screen for the YouTube video. And that's been taken from Reptile Lighting Facebook group as well. So all credit goes to them with this image. But it gives a perfect example of how your UV light should be positioned with your basking light. And we have gone for the diagonal approach at one end of the vivarium with the basking spot placed in the centre of it, but behind it, if that makes sense. And we find that this gives the best gradient when using a 22-inch kit. This is all part of what is now known as the light and shade method. You can actually still put some light into the vivarium if you want to, not fully down to the cool end, because obviously that would eliminate the light and shade method, but you can put jungle dawns in or any white LED lights, which would encourage and activate the circadian rhythm in the bearded dragon, which I'll discuss a tiny bit more on later down the line in what I'm chatting about. I also decided that I would create my own diagrams. And the reason for that is I know that I get a lot of questions with how do I set up the vivarium, where does everything need to be placed, them kind of questions. So I do advise, if you're not comfortable with using a 6%, then 12 is fine, providing you use the recommended distances. So I've done a diagram for both the 6% and the 12% vivarium setup. Because of it obviously being a 2D image that I've created. I can't really replicate the diagonal approach of the UV on the diagram, but preferably diagonal is better, in my opinion. You don't have to do it diagonal, but we think it makes more sense to do it that way. You can still see what I mean with the previous image that come from Reptile Lighting Facebook group. What I decided to do was chat a bit around the UVI distance chart, which is created in the Reptile Lighting group as well. But it's just the Arcadia Pro T5 22 inch fixing. It gives a really good example of distances with a 6, a 12 and a 14% bulb. Obviously 14% being too high for a dragon. 12% is pretty much bearable. If you've got a taller viv than 2 foot, then 12% could be quite good, especially because you'd then be able to increase the basking zone. But in my opinion, I'd prefer to use 6%. Again, like I said before, because you can have more enrichment in that area if you're using a lesser percentage bulb, but they're still getting adequate UVI. When it comes to lights, it is better to get a dimming thermostat that also has a timer plug with it. This is because you can then plug all your UVB into the timer and have both your heating and your lighting controlled at the same time, because it's important to keep to the cycles, which you would find in the wild, really. So we tend to stick to a 12-hour cycle throughout the spring and summer months and a 10-hour cycle during the autumn and winter months. So the reason that we tend to use cycles that would mimic the wild is because bearded dragons have got a third eye called the parietal eye. The parietal eye has got a lens, a cornea and a retina, and the bearded dragon's third eye does not see images. So instead, the eye uses a biochemical means to detect light. Where's a bearded dragon's third eye? So the parietal eye is connected to the pineal gland, and together the parietal eye and the pineal gland are known as the pineal complex, which are both photosensitive. So the third eye usually sends signals to the pineal gland by communicating with optic center of the brain. The parietal eye has been shown to assist diurnal lizards in regulating the amount of sunlight they need and preventing any excessive metabolic activity, which, as most people know, it does shorten the life. So the parietal eye detects light and dark, measuring the photo period of light. The pineal gland produces different hormones depending on the time of day, including, you know, like melatonin. And that obviously helps with the sleep and wake cycle. It's the same in humans. It's the same in most animals, actually. The pineal complex sets the internal clock, detecting the seasons and even the time of day, which then in turn regulates the production of hormones. The third eye actually has a role to play as well in appetite, level of energy, early warning of predators overhead, that kind of thing. It could be the reason that bearded dragons can become scared about being outside when it's used to being indoors. So I've got a dragon like that. His name's Oregon, and he's the most mellow dragon ever. Even during breeding season, I mean, he goes black from the tip of under his beard all the way up to the bottom of his tail, but he's not aggressive to humans at all. And the minute that you take him into the garden, he just goes mental. He'll puff his beard up, he'll puff his body up, he'll start hissing and everything. He just doesn't like me. He just
not job mode.
Yeah. And it just makes sense that the third eye is the reason why they can become terrified about being outdoors.
He recognises he's in an open
space. Yeah, they recognise it, don't they? So it makes a lot of sense. And the change in the quality and brightness in light from artificial light to sunlight is what probably causes the scared reaction of a bearded dragon when it's been taken from indoors to outdoors. I do know that in 1958, there was experiments conducted on the parietal eye. And although it's an old study, it's still got some quite cool information. So the third eye was actually removed from some types of lizard, mainly iguanas. And the reason for this is because they wanted to see how the lizard would react once it had its third eye removed. I think they then went on to also remove the pineal complex, you know, like the pineal glands. The results from it was that the lizards were slower to seek refuge from a predator. They emerged earlier in the morning increased the time that they spent in sunlight and or artificial light, increased exposure to high temperatures and subsequently greater activity, but the body temperature was equivalent to a normal lizard. So the increased metabolism combined with the lack of food resulted in quicker death, basically. And lastly, they noticed that the thyroid gland was enlarged, and that was all from studying the removal of a third eye in an iguana. It's quite interesting, but we can actually help assist the third eye with our husbandry practices, such as never approaching a bearded dragon from overhead. I think that's a well-known one. Do not provide bearded dragons with light at night, because they're obviously a diurnal species, and I have had stink eyes before when I've put the reptile room light on. They've opened one eye and just literally stirred through my existence. Yeah.
Food, go away.
It's honestly, they just don't like it. Moving between sunlight and artificial light, another one. Bright tank light is critical to biological functions, so obviously keep the UVB up to date. Your basking light needs to be on, and you can add some white LED lights or get the branded ones, which are the Arcadia Jungle Dawns. And lastly, you can automate the lighting cycles with timers, which is a big one, really. That's why I suggested with the dimming thermostat, you get one that's got a timer attached to it, because it's much more helpful for the circadian rhythm to stay on target. Along with bright light, lighting cycles are needed to ensure that the right level of hormone and other biological functions of the dragon are working correctly. So that's another reason why we would automate the lighting cycles, to ensure that there's, you know, a consistency similar to that of a natural environment outdoors. It is definitely essential for the bearded dragon's circadian rhythm that they're provided with total darkness and night and bright white light during the day, preferably sunlight. The third eye is actually capable of sensing ultra-red and ultraviolet light, which may disrupt any sleep. It's quite interesting, the circadian rhythm and the third eye. So when I do an episode on the UVB, I'll probably go more into depth about it so that people can understand more of the science behind it. But if anyone's wondering what a circadian rhythm is, it's exactly the same in humans. It's a physical, mental and behavioural change that follow a 24-hour cycle. So the natural processes that respond primarily to light and dark and affect most living things. Like I said, it affects humans, but it also includes any animals, plants, microbes, that kind of thing. So it's a huge part of a captive reptile's life, really. The third eye and the circadian rhythm go hand in hand together. And in order for them both to work in unison, they both need to have all the needs met. I think I've delved enough into the UVB side and how important it is for the dragon. So I'll move on to substrate now. When you first bring a reptile home, it's always recommended that there should be a quarantine period of at least 3 months. That is something that we adhere to, and that is something that we recommend keeping new and old.
Regardless of how many animals you have. Yeah,
regardless of how many animals you have, it's always best to have a 3-month quarantine period. So during that period, we recommend using kitchen roll or newspaper, something that's easily exchangeable when it comes to clean out time, and something that you can visually see that the dragon has pooped on, basically, and you know that everything's working as it should. If loose substrate was given immediately, then obviously feces could be missed, and any owner could mistake the reptile for not passing feces.
They're ill. No, it doesn't matter how good your husbandry is. There is a chance they will become impacted.
Yeah. Once the quarantine's over, there are a number of different ways you can successfully keep a dragon. Although we do recommend the most natural setup, as it does reflect how they'd live outside of captivity. Although you can buy products that are substrate, you know, like bearded dragon life and that kind of thing, you can actually make your own. So we recommend a sand-soil ratio of 50-50. And you can also add excavator clay if you want to, which would mean that if the dragon did dig, it wouldn't collapse as readily as it would with just sand and soil. If you do want to add excavator clay, the ratio that you should take is a 50-30-20. So that's 50 sand, 30 soil and 20 clay. And we only recommend this for dragons that are over 6 months old. Below 6 months old, we suggest sticking with kitchen roll, lino or, you know, newspaper, which allows you to monitor health for longer. I know that a lot of people say only do loose substrate over 1 year old, but in my experience and in my opinion, 6 months old is fine, providing that your husbandry is on point. You only really see cases of impaction and that kind of thing when usually something's incorrect with the husbandry. So we do, and we have kept reptiles on loose substrate from 6 months old without a problem. As usual, we'd always say calcium sand should be avoided. We just think it's not worth it. For those people who'd rather not use loose substrate, because I know it's difficult to know what to believe when there's so many contrasting opinions and there's so much information out there. So if it worries you, then I would suggest maybe sticking with lino or maybe half lino, half tile or slate, that kind of appearance. I mean, I do know people that use half AstroTurf, but obviously more to the cool side because AstroTurf can heat up quite a lot. So if you was going to take that approach, it'd be more over to the cool side than it would be to the warm side. But for new beginners, I'd say lino or half lino, half slate for those that don't want to try loose substrate once the quarantine period's over.
How do you feel about reptile carpet?
The thing with reptile carpet is it's pointless with bearded dragons, especially babies, because it just gets filthy and they poo that much that reptile carpet isn't worth having in with them. Not to mention the fact that it just doesn't look realistic at all anyway. There is a lot of truth in the fact that it does harbour bacteria. So got to do a lot of machine washing and that kind of thing. But in my opinion, I probably would stay away from reptile carpet, especially with dragons, because as it does harbour germs, dragons are so messy when it comes to poop and stuff like that, especially if you don't catch it on the spot clean quite quickly after they've pooped, because they'll just keep running through it.
Like with clothes, if you've got a 10-year-old t-shirt, it, no matter how much you wash it, it will keep the smell in, like an old smell. That's what reptile carpet does.
So I would say don't use reptile carpet with bearded dragons.
It's like, it's one of those things, it's an option, but it's not the best option.
Yeah, it's an option.
In captivity, you want to do the best.
Yeah, and like Nick was saying, because it does harbour germs, even when you machine wash it, there's germs there. It's easier, if you're going to go down that route, you might as well use kitchen roll, because every piece you put back down is clean. You've not washed it, you've not, you know, done anything like that. It's just clean. So if you want a sterile environment, then I'd say use kitchen roll, not reptile carp. I'm just going to cover a bit about feeding and supplements. So with bearded dragon babies, they do require a lot of protein in order to continue to grow properly. I'd recommend that people feed around 2 to 3 times a day. So we usually start by throwing a few feeders in at a time to the group, because we house our babies in smaller groups of between 5 and 7 dragons. It just depends on what the clutch we've had amounts to at the time. By throwing a few in at a time, you can then see who's taking what, and once feeding has taken place, any excess bugs that are no longer wanted, we can then take out. It's always best to watch your reptile once you're feeding them, because you'll know what they're eating. You'll know how many they've eaten. If you don't take them out, it can actually stress the animal. So we do recommend that you remove them, but we know that sometimes, especially crickets and dubias actually, that's if you don't use a bowl. You can have stragglers of either really. So we tend to throw a carrot in overnight, and that's just as a precaution that we may not have got them all, despite the fact that we think we have. So it just means that it gives the feeder something to go and eat rather than pestering the dragons. We do provide a mix of spring greens daily, which are dusted with calcium. And the thing with that is it's always better to keep offering baby dragons greens, despite the fact that they mainly just pick at them. And that's obviously due to hydration. They're very good for hydration purposes. I know that you sometimes just see them picking here and there, but they will be taking a level of greens on board, enough to provide, you know, some hydration to them.
And it's, that's better than nothing.
Yeah, it's better than nothing. And so we always say, regardless of whether you physically see the dragon eating any, always put them in anyway, because it will then get used to being offered salad as well. So once the dragon reaches around 6 months old, the feeds can be reduced to around twice a day. When they reach 12 months old, you'd want to reduce down to around one feed a day. When the dragon reaches 18 months old, the feeds should be reduced one final time to three times a week. And that's the way that we've always worked things. And it's worked for, gosh, plenty years now. well over a decade. That's what we would recommend. We do always recommend a varied diet, because I know that some people will ask, can we just feed one thing? For instance, I've had people ask, oh, we don't like crickets and locusts or anything that runs. Is there any chance we can just feed Morio worms, or is there any chance we can just feed buffalo worms, that kind of thing?
Don't like anything that has legs.
Yeah, people do ask if you can just feed one feeder that might be preferable to them, but the short answer to that is no, because they do need a varied diet. So everything has its place in the feeding schedule. You should be feeding crickets, locusts, dubia roaches. You can also feed silkworms and calciworms as a staple, but the likes of Morio worms and mealworms should only be fed sparingly, because obviously they've got more fat content than other feeders. But everything has its place when you're feeding a reptile. So regardless of what information you might hear, like, oh, don't feed them them, oh, don't feed them them, I strongly believe that everything has a place. And in moderation and with the right feeding schedule, you can provide a varied diet with pretty much all insects. I do think everything has a place, and I've included that in the care sheet as well. The other thing for newer keepers to bear in mind is appropriately sized feeders. The general rule of thumb is no wider than the space between the animal's eyes and no longer than the animal's head in length. For instance, for my 8-week-old dragons, I usually feed medium to large crickets, large locusts, medium dubias, and smaller Morio worms. As I've just previously said, animals will always thrive more when they're offered a varied diet, as opposed to always sticking to the same feeder every time. With regards to ratios, I tend to tell people not to obsess over them too much. So as long as you've got your feeding schedule and what you're supplementing and that kind of thing, that's your schedule. You don't really need to think of it as a ratio. But the ratio that I've always known would be 80% bugs as a baby and 20% salad. So as the dragon hits adulthood, it reverses the ratio. So then the ratio then becomes 80% salad and 20% bugs. But like I said, I wouldn't think too much into the ratio side of things as such, providing that you've got your feeding schedule correct and your supplementation schedule correct. Which brings me to chat about the Arcadia supplement range of products. So that's the range that we use. And when dusting, we do follow their schedule as well. The schedule, when we follow it with the dragons, is per feeds, not days. And that's because obviously most of our dragons are adults and they only need feeding three times a week. So I'll put the image up on the screen of what Arcadia recommends. And I've also included that in the guide that I've made. They do some really good products. We use Arcadia Earth Pro Air, which is a multivitamin that doesn't contain D3, because you don't want a vitamin that contains D3 all of the time when you're using a T5 bulb. We did use Nutribol, but after speaking to Cand and doing some extra research, we decided to move to the Revitalize, which is also an Arcadia product that does contain D3. So on every 8th feed, you can dust with Revitalize, which does include D3. And it only needs to be a very, very light dusting, because it's just to make sure that they're getting what they need. Particularly with babies, you want to make sure that they're getting the right amount of D3. So I guess it's just as a safeguarding, really, that you can add the dusting on the 8th feed in. But again, research shows that it's not actually necessary as such. It's just as a precaution. With regards to the feeding schedule, the first 3 feeds are Earth Pro Air, which is without the D3 in. The fourth feed is calcium pro MG. And then the three subsequent feeds after that are also Earth Pro A. And like I said, the eighth feed is the revitalize. You can also, if you really want to, there is a shed support supplement that you can use, and it can be added to the diet over the shedding period. So when you notice that your dragon is coming into the white and they're going to have a shed, you can include a dusting of shed support alongside your other supplements, just so that it helps with the shedding. So that's always recommended, because I know there was a question that asked about what's the best way to get the shed from round bearded dragon's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are using the Arcadia supplement regime, you can trial the shed support around the time that your dragon is going into shed. You can use it with all reptile species. It's safe, but you can use it with your dragon. The other thing is with shedding, I do know that it can get stuck in funny places, but the best thing that you can do is to give them a shallow bath in just lukewarm water or room temperature water. Trickle the water over the head. Give them 5 or 10 minutes in the water. After that, it becomes quite soft, so they can usually go back into the vivarium and rub it off themselves, providing that you've got the right amount of branches and bark and that kind of thing that they can rub the body onto to safely get the shed away. If that's not the case, you can soak their eyes to make it a bit looser and then use a cotton bud very gently around that area to get the skin off. You can use your hands if you want, if you feel like you're more confident in doing that. If not, you can use a wet cotton bud that usually helps with pushing it out. So I'm just going to go through a couple of things that I think is important when keeping a bearded dragon as well, especially if you're keeping them for the first time. I've included a warning in the cur guide. That's because people think that bearded dragons are sociable, and they're not social animals. They like to be on their own. When you see a bearded dragon hugging, they're not hugging, they're showing dominance. They don't want to share the territory. So the warning I've included is your animals should be housed separately. If left in a setup together, it can lead to fighting, and it can also lead to death.
Nip tails.
Yeah, we've got a bearded dragon called Apricot, and she's off a good friend of ours. And unfortunately, she was sold to somebody that was dishonest to our friend. And the dragon was a baby, and she got put in with an adult dragon. Now, she unfortunately had her tail ripped off, and thankfully, she was tucked to the vet quite quickly. And the vet had to amputate further up the tail to save it. Her nickname Stumpy, but her name is actually Apricot. But she's thriving, she's fine, she's doing well, she'll live out her days with us. But that's just a perfect example of why you shouldn't cohabit, and especially you wouldn't add a baby bearded dragon to an adult vivarium. The likelihood is that the baby will either be severely injured or eaten. And it's a horrible thing to happen, but you need to go into it knowing that they aren't sociable animals. They don't want to be housed together with any other animals.
Is there any signs that you can look out for to know that, you know, if you say go into a shop or have a friend that's housing them together, is there any signs that you can point out to said people, said person, of an unhappy dragon or of a dragon or dragons that are going to end up fighting, things like that, sort of like the dominance behavior?
Well, you find that there's always one that is picked on more than the rest, and they spend a lot of time losing weight. Actually, you find that they lose weight, they don't want to eat as much, or they can't eat as much because the food's taken. Other thing to watch for with bearded dragons is because they've got a lot of behavioural traits, so the likes of males will obviously get the black beard, they'll puff out, they'll head bob. They head bob for dominance, but they also head bob very, very fast if they're doing it for dominance over a female, whereas females will head bob in a very slow motion and arm wave to accept a male. But they will also head bob. Well, it's more like, I find that it's more like they'll lower the head rather than bob it to say, I'm submitting and you know, it's fine, you can be here. But that's a lot of the time, that's usually with males. You find that the first instance that I said about the not eating and the being picked at and being lied on top of a lot, that's usually one of the signs, because it's a lot of dominant.
Me just stop with the whole, they're fine. If they started fighting, I'll split them up. You shouldn't be waiting for it to get to that point. Like, you shouldn't be waiting for your animals to get injured before, you know, you actually start listening. It shouldn't have to come to that. You know, so housing them together, especially beardies, it's just from pure laziness. At the end of the day, it's either you don't want to buy the extra viv, or, you know, you don't want to spend the extra money. To me, it is just pure laziness. Obviously, if they don't know, and obviously they even know, you know, pet stores and all that have given them false information, that's a completely different story. That's them just, you know, not genuinely knowing. But if they do know and are aware and have been told, and they're still choosing to be like, no, they're fine, they're friends, they love each other, then yeah, I think it's just pure laziness. And yeah, not a huge fan of it when it comes to, I'm always seeing that as an excuse to why they do it.
I don't think it should be a case of, if something happens, I'll split them up. You don't,
because that something could be a dead dragon,
yeah,
and a hefty vet bill for the other one.
And the other thing to consider as well is, so if you've got more than one female in a vivarium, when a bearded dragon is ovulating, the female can become quite aggressive to other females in the vicinity. Mm-hmm. And that's usually when fights start to happen, more so than any other time. That's something to take into consideration as well. It's not so bad with females outside of the vivarium, because it's a neutral territory. So they don't tend to be as fussed by one another when they're not in their space. When they're in their space, they're just tolerating one another. And unfortunately, people fail to see that a lot of the time.
People just think they're best friends.
Yeah, and it's not the case at all. One of them is lower on the hierarchy than the other, and generally, if they was to put a foot out of line, then the other one
would not exist for much longer.
No, exactly. Just a few other bits that I think is important when you're keeping a bearded dragon. So I tend to soak my dragons between 1 to 3 times a week, and because it helps with hydration and cleaning, especially when they're younger, because they're so mucky. I know that some people say, oh no, don't bath them at all, and some people say, oh, only bath them once a week, but it's something that has always worked with me, and I'm happy with that approach. The other thing is, I do recommend a parasite check at least once a year. It can be done via an online outlet that checks for parasites, and they do send you like a PDF of the results, and then you can forward them on or take them into your local reptile vet if treatment is needed, because usually it's like a traffic light system when you get parasite results, and they will advise you if they think that treatment is needed, or they will say, look, it's slightly high, speak to your vet and see whether they think treatment is needed. So sometimes they don't give a definitive answer. They say, speak to your vet first, see what they say. But I do think it's important. I mean, you can also go for something like a yearly check, which they'll run a parasite test at your vet's in the yearly check anyway. But I do recommend you do it around, say, the end of September, beginning of October. And the reason for that is brumation, which is the bearded dragon version of hibernation. If you're going to, so looking at it from just a keeper perspective, you can't let your dragon go into brumation without knowing whether it's got a parasite load or not, because the parasites can kill your dragon whilst it's brumating. They can strip it of its nutrients and that kind of thing, and unfortunately the dragon won't make it. So it's always best to get a parasite test in that respect, so that you're keeping your dragon safe. On the flip side, when it comes to breeding dragons, it's always best to get any of the breeders that you're planning on pairing in the new breeding season parasite checked, because you don't want to pass them on to any babies. And also, you don't want to have the same thing occur when brumation might occur. Because I find more often than not, it's usually the males that go into brumation more than what the females do. And it's just a good idea to always have them health checked before they go into that state. another thing is, if you've got babies under 1 year old, if your husbandry is on point, they generally won't go into bromation because it's not something that they do in the first year usually. If you find that they start going into bromation early, then you probably need a vet check just to double check that everything's as it should be. The other thing is, all reptiles do carry small amounts of pinworm in the system anyway. It's just when it's coupled with other parasite flare-ups, such as, you know, like cicada or protozoa, the pinworm will then become a problem because it reaches higher levels. So that's one thing to consider. So a lot of the time when you get parasite test results, they come back with pinworm, and that's okay in small amounts because, oddly enough, none of the vets have ever agreed on a parasite count scale. So a lot of the time they've all got their own scales that they find within reasonable margins, shall we say. For some reason, it's never been cast iron, the scale of how much pinworm you can have in your system or how much you can't have in your system, that kind of thing. So each vet you'll find that does a parasite check, the margins will be completely different to the next vet that does a parasite check or a parasite check that's done online, that kind of thing. There is similarities in the margins that they use. There has to be in one sense, but for some reason, it's not something that they've ever set in stone, which I find strange, but it's just...
Yeah, it's kind of strange, isn't it?
Yeah, it's, for some reason, it's just the way that they tend to work. Providing that the pinworm's in low amounts, then that's completely normal. Usually it's not something that vets will treat because, like I said, it's already part of the makeup, really. And lastly, the other thing to look out for is any sort of cues for possible parasite infestation. Say, for instance, earlier in the year than what you would usually test, your dragon might start having a loss of appetite, weight loss, lethargy, loose smelly stool, pale gums or tongue. They can all be signs of a parasite infection. So I would suggest if you have any of those type of symptoms, then a vet check is probably needed, or send off for a parasite check, and, you know, just to be on the safe side.
Better to be safe than sorry. Yeah.
Even if it is a bit earlier in the year than what you would usually test, it's better to get tested and do it that way. The other thing we keep in bearded dragons is, I'm going to do a separate podcast on this because although I'm going to chat quickly about common illnesses, I think and feel it would be good to have a podcast that maybe went a bit more in depth about each one and the symptoms specifically for each one and what you can maybe do to help whilst you're waiting for veterinary treatment. With regards to the more common ones, so you've got your metabolic bone disease, also known as MBD. You've got your mouth rot. You've got your parasites, which, you know, there's multiple different types. So if I do a separate podcast, we can discuss the nature of each parasite and the form of treatment that's, you know, that's given for particular kinds of parasites and how they affect the body. There's respiratory infections. There's York colomitis, which is quite an in-depth one to cover that one, actually. It's becoming more and more common in this day and age now because females are getting overfed. Well, males are getting overfed as well. But what I mean is females, it's detrimental to not to be overfed because if a female dragon's well cared for with lots of calcium, vitamins, gut-loaded insects, vegetables, fruits, then a body puts the extra nutrients into developing egg follicles. And what I mean by that is they're like eggs, but they don't have a shell, so they can't be laid. And that means that she's then carrying a load of egg yolks and they're never going to be absorbed and they're never going to turn into actual eggs. With that in mind, eventually the yolks get so big inside the female that it then causes an infection called yolk peritonitis. It either causes an infection or the yolks burst. And if the yolks burst, it then causes the infection anyway. If you go into Reptile Intelligence UK, search for York colomitis, I did a big write-up on it and it pretty much covers everything that you need to know, including symptoms and treatment, which unfortunately, rarely you're able to get to a vet in time for treatment to take place, which the treatment is obviously the removal of the ovaries and everything included. So if you get your dragon there on time, then I've known some dragons to have a good chance of survival. Usually, unfortunately, it's too late by the time they start displaying symptoms. It's not a very good outcome, unfortunately. But if you're interested in reading about it before I do the podcast that specifically outlines what it is, why it happens, all the symptoms, then you can read up about it. And I've also included a diagram of the bearded dragon and where the follicles are in relation to the body part. It's quite interesting. If you're interested in knowing more about that, then have a quick read of it. The other one is adenovirus. So there's quite a lot of dispute over that in recent years, whether it's real, whether it's not, that kind of thing. There's definitely something. I'll speak more in depth about that on the other podcast as well. With regards to what you can try and do to keep on top of your dragon's health, I'm not a reptile vet or a reptile health expert. This is just based on my own experience, my own observation. And if you do have an emergency, then I'd recommend that you call a vet ASAP. In my opinion, it's better to weigh your bearded dragon weekly, because sudden weight loss can indicate a health issue. Keep a weekly record of weight, feeding habits, behaviour, shedding. Then you've got everything there in front of you to say, well, my dragon's behaving a bit differently, and here's the records that prove that. And lastly, I would always recommend that you prepare a reptile first aid kit. So if they do become ill or need any extra help, you've got everything there at home until you can manage to get to the vets when they've got an appointment. This is just what I've got at home in my first aid kit. Tamidine, critical care formula, 5 mil syringes, tweezers, Verm X and RetiBoost. All of them things are a really good thing to have in your reptile cupboard. And all of them are really good and really helpful for different things. So obviously Tamidine's an antibacterial wound cleaner. Very good if your reptile accidentally gets a cut or a burn. It's just a good all-rounder.
That helped me a lot with Zira when I had
I remember saying use Tamidine and it did help you. Care formula, you can make that. I tend to, if I ever need to use that with a dragon or a Leo or anything like that, I tend to make it into a watery substance that I can put in a syringe, although it can be made into a paste that you can feed to them. I prefer to just put it into a syringe because it's just easier to administer, and that's got all your vitamins in, it's got protein in. It can be used to solely feed a reptile whilst they're in recovery from anything, really, maybe an operation, that kind of thing. It'll give them everything they need for the short-term scenario. The 5 mil syringes are what we use. You can get loads, to be honest, on eBay. You can get like a pack of 50 for less than a tenner, but obviously they don't need needles on or anything like that. It's just purely a plastic syringe that you can use to administer your critical care or RetiBoost, that kind of thing. Tweezers, I always find tweezers are really helpful, because if you get a dragon with a stuck nose trumpet, as I call them, you can use them to help remove them. If it looks like it's starting to aggravate the dragon, 9 times out of 10, they'll get rid of it themselves. It's just the shed skin that goes into the nose because they've got really long nose canals. But there's always one eventually that might need a bit of extra help. Alternatively as well, when Helios was alive, we had to use tweezers sometimes to remove food from his throat, because he was terrible for storing food in his throat, and the vet removed it a few times as well with tweezers. So we have a set of long tweezers that if should any animal start to choke, we're able to remove what is in the throat visually. If it's too far down, in which case that happened to Helios the last time he was at the vet before he passed away, they had to use a suction on him to remove it from his throat. An LED torch is another one that we've got as well, because they're really handy to have. You can use the torch in unison with the tweezers if you ever need to remove anything. But we've only had to do that with one dragon. And that's because genetically he wasn't the best and he had his problems, and unfortunately he didn't survive. But we had everything there that we could that would help him, and he had numerous vet visits. So a torch and tweezers are always a good thing to have. Vermex, I find that's a really good thing to have. You dust your feeders across 3 days once a month, and it promotes healthy gut bacteria. So it's actually good for keeping parasites at bay and that kind of thing, and keeping the intestines working properly. So yeah, that's another good one to have in the kit. And lastly is Reptiboost. I always find that Reptiboost is awesome when you've got a female that's ovulating, even if you're not breeding her, or you've got a gravid female, or you've got a female that's just laid eggs and needs a boost. It provides them with some extra vitamins to get them back to optimal health after the breeding season, and we use it for that. So that's what I'd recommend in a reptile first aid kit. So I'm just going to share some information about bearded dragon genetics, because in all honesty, I see it all the time, people purring morphs that shouldn't really be purred and taking the strength of the gene back a few years by doing it. It's sort of like 5 steps forward and 10 steps backwards.
Oh, the worst.
Yeah, and especially in bearded dragons. So unless you're willing to strengthen them, then you're just making them weaker.
Mm.
It's easier to explain the morphs first. Right, so there's 8 existing incomplete dominant recessive genetics currently in the species. So that is the hypomelanistic, which is also known as the hypo. There's the translucent, which is also known as the trans. There's the American leather, the Italian leather, and the silkback. There's the phantom leather, which is actually a recessive leather. There's the Dunner, the Whitblitz, the Zero, and the Silverback. So let's start off with Tiger isn't a morph. It's a line-bred pattern phase. The interesting one is Genetic Stripe. That also isn't a morph. It's a line-bred pattern phase. The Phantom Stripe isn't a morph. It's a line-bred colour phase. Colour or Visual Stripe isn't a morph. It's a line-bred colour phase that is derived from actual Phantom Stripe lineage, which is Tracy Saltmarsh in America. She runs Phantom Dragons. In fact, we've got most of the morphs that we've got today because of her and a partner that worked on them and run them through the ranks to get them to be healthy. Another one is colour is not a morph. You see a lot of the time people suggesting that the colour's a morph. It's not a morph. Hypo, which is actually one of my favourites, it's a recessive. It's a reduction of dark pigment in the animal, and the nails will always usually appear to be opaque or yellow. The translucent gene is a recessive. It's basically a lack of white pigment. The animals appear sort of gummy and more intensely coloured. So Santaru I kept back from my coral project.
Oh, that is such a
good one. I'll put a photo on actually whilst we're chatting on this part, and I'll show you what I mean by gummy. You'll see straight away what it means. So as babies, the bellies also appear blue, and sometimes above their eyes will also have a blue tint. I've found that 99% of translucents do have a blue-black tint over their eyes. You can tell usually as soon as their eyelids out the egg whether they're going to be translucent.
You can eyelid.
Yeah. The American leather is a form of incomplete dominant leather that pops out in the USA. It's less consistent in scale reduction than an Italian leather. It is also compatible with an Italian leather. So when bred together, they can produce the homozygous form, which is obviously what we know as the silkback. The Italian leather is another form of incomplete dominant leather that popped out in Italy. It's got quite a consistent scale reduction, and it's quite a bit smoother than the American leather. So incomplete dominant animals are usually actually visual hets. They're the heterozygous form of a silkback. So the silkback is the homozygous superform of a leatherback. Silks lack scale completely, with some retaining the pseudoscales. So I know there's a question about, do I agree with breeding silkbacks? The short answer to that is no. I do know that in order to sometimes further a project, silkbacks have to be created. And usually in that respect, not many pop out. I personally don't breed them, but I think that anybody that does should already have homes available for them because they've got extra needs with regards to the skin. So because the skin is so sensitive, usually it needs to be moisturized. And
they're ugly.
Yeah, I just wouldn't do it. I do disagree with breeding for silkbacks purposely. It's a no.
They have quite a hefty price tag on them.
Sometimes, yes. And I do believe it's the people that don't know what they're actually doing that put a hefty price tag on them. They think, oh, wow, these are silkbacks. We've created something awesome. That's what we was aiming to hit. Well, I wouldn't aim to hit that at all. And I do know that breeders who do try and further genes sometimes have to create them. They're not doing it purposely to create silkbacks. They're doing it to create a stronger gene because not all of the clutch would be silkbacks, if that makes sense.
So you can kind of tell who's doing it for...
Yeah, definitely.
...what reasons.
Yeah, 100%.
Kind of by the price tag, okay?
Yeah.
No. 150,000% no. They shouldn't be bred purposely. You're taking away all of an animal's natural defences. What? The fact that you like the look of them, and that's not on. That's not fair. So I know a breeder who was purposely breeding them and then selling them, but you have to be educated when you take on a silkback because the slightest scratch completely tears the skin. They've got to constantly be moisturized. They're awful at shedding. So you're just stripping everything that a bearded dragon is known for. Their hardiness, their skin toughness, everything. You don't give them any of that. You're basically producing a defenseless animal.
Yeah.
UV, they've got no protection against UV at all. So no, I don't agree with it. Them and thunderbolts.
Wait, what's a thunderbolt?
A genetic time bomb.
Oh, is it going to be one of them geneticals again?
So basically, three different morphs to create a stronger colour pattern, a stronger unique colour pattern. But the way they're paired together, so it's like they'll put closely related trans together. Now, you shouldn't do that. Because it can cause severe neurological issues in the animals. Thunderbolts usually die within the first couple of years. Like silkbacks. Silkbacks don't have a good lifespan. They just don't. They usually die before the five. So within the first 2 years of life, most silkbacks will die. Thunderbolts are the same. It's a genetic mess. Now, people who say, oh, yeah, we've got really good, a really strong line of thunderbolts and stuff. Like, well, you shouldn't be pairing them anyway. It's been proven.
There is none of the original line left.
No, there's none of the
original.
So
they're not really true
thunderbolts.
Thunderbolts or such.
It's like the German giant. There's no true German giants left.
Mad.
But yeah, it's a genetic mess. And I don't agree with people pairing it because you're too close. So with dragon genetics, it takes many years for the line to be strong enough. So for hypo, it can now be paired hypo to hypo instead of het to het because it's a strong line now. It's been around that long and it's been outsourced. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Trans is still on the iffy side because, as I said, trans to trans can cause genetic neurological issues, such as tremors, balance issues.
The back legs are usually largely affected in a double trans pairing. Visually at birth, that can happen. When you're looking at the longer lasting effects that only start to appear once a dragon matures, you're looking at tremors and balance problems. And I've also noticed that they don't absorb the supplements as well as what other dragons do. So it drastically reduces the lifespan. And actually, Amy in America from Upscale Dragons, she's been chatting a lot about it lately. Because of a mishap that happened in her breeding. And I think she's done an awesome job at bringing it to the forefront. You know, this is what happens when a double trans pairing occurs. And if you are not convinced now that you shouldn't do it, then have a look at these images. If you're not convinced after them, then, you know, you're doing something
wrong.
You've
got no morals. So she's been really transparent and she's been really informative about it. And that's the best way to be. If something's happened, let's all learn from it. It needs to be said. I mean, what are people gaining from purposely purring things that would cause a mess? Well, yeah, I mean, people say money, but a lot of time and effort goes into bringing them up and stuff like that. And I get what
not everyone
puts in the work that you do, though.
Yeah.
Everyone goes above and beyond to ensure that their beardies are of the highest quality and are of the best condition. So, yeah, you and, you know, and whoever you, obviously I'm not a beardie breeder, but whoever you and whoever you think and all the other people that, you know, go above and beyond, they're not going to be making, a profit, as people call it, because of how much time and energy and all that food, all that varied diet. It's not cheap, it's expensive. And you're not going to be seeing anything out of that. But you know, you've got happy animals and happy new owners with a new pet and all that. But not everyone goes through all that extra trouble because it's a lot of work. Oh, it's a lot of work, isn't it? It's a lot of work. And that takes out of their profit. And so not a lot of people are going to be putting in that extra work because they want the biggest profit. So a lot of people would be doing it for profit and preying on people that either don't know genetics or, you know, and things like that.
Well, 9 times out of 10 with a double transpirin, if you don't have a baby that's got a visual problem, they will have a neurological one further down the line. And that's the harsh reality of it.
It's the same with the zero gene. It's not strong. It's just not strong at all. And I know that Tracy of Phantom, she's had so many disagreements with people online because their philosophy is, well, I've got 5 babies that have been healthy out of it. So, but what about the other 20 babies you hatched that aren't? They've got like deformities, a reduced lifespan, probably genital issues that you can't visually see. Like, it's not a strong line. And as Stacey mentioned earlier, she's the one that has, her and Josh are the ones that have strengthened this line, trying to put us forward with it. And every time a visual to visual or visual to het is paired, you're putting that line 5 years back, because it's then being palmed off to someone with all its issues who might not be aware of the issues, who then pair it on, and the cycle continues. So that's, I think people forget that you need to be able to, your breeder needs to be transparent with what they're doing. Any decent breeder will happily, they might not always want to show your parents. I know some big breeders don't like showing parents because obviously there is a few people who have a business of it, all like the right channels and everything. So they've got a lot at stake. So when you won't have the parents being seen and stuff because they're then a target for people who want to steal and things like that. Completely understandable. But they will tell you and know the lineage. They'll know the entire lineage. So usually they'll have grandparents info and everything, and they'll be transparent about it. But so this way it comes in, you need to trust the breeder you're going to, and they, you need to know some knowledge yourself. Say, hang on, that what they're saying doesn't add up at all from everything I've learned.
Yeah, don't be afraid to call people out if you think it's wrong, because it could just be that you have accidentally mixed up a bit of information in your head, and they can help you. Like, obviously, as long as you're not doing it in sort of like a, you know, you're wrong, I've learned this, I know more than you, I've been here 2 minutes. Like, as long as you're not doing it in that way and you're genuinely just trying to learn, I don't see anyone that's decent having an issue with that and having an issue with helping, because at the end of the day, the more people that have beardies, like, that's more people in the community, that's more people, you know, strengthening lines, as you said, you know, and doing and helping, and it's more of a community, isn't it? Because, you know, it's more of a community, like, the more, like, the merrier.
You need to be open with your thinking of it, whether it be with the genetics or with the husbandry. Now, I know a lot of beardy communities are stuck in their ways, and it's at the detrimental effect to that beardy's health. Like, overexposure to UV, overfeeding, over-supplementing, you know, that sort of stuff. But, like, humanising the animal. Oh, it's come out, it's cuddled, it's fell asleep on me cuddling. It's like, it's fell asleep because it's cold. That's the short and tall of it. That animal is cold. This is why we keep them in controlled, regulated environments. So, breeder, keeper, somebody interested, doesn't matter. You need to be open to learn. Just because you've worked with the animal for, what, 40 years doesn't mean you know all the answers, because science and technology is constantly changing.
No such thing.
Open to that change. It's like, I still see now people recommending for nighttime, give a dragon a heat mat. That's pointless. Don't give your dragon a heat mat at night. In fact, let the temperature drop. All species should have a temperature drop, because that's what happens in the wild. You don't need a 24-hour regulated environment of constant heat, the same heat. They don't come out to bask at night.
They're kipping.
Yeah. They don't come out to bask at night. They go off and they burrow, which is why we provide hides and stuff, because they'll go off and they'll find somewhere secure to hide. What's the less chance you're going to get eaten hiding away?
You can't see me.
So it's like with the DHP thing with Leos and stuff. Oh, just keep it at a constant temp 24 hours with the DHP because it doesn't emit light. No, don't. Have a light emitting bulb through the day. And if you want to get really fancy, instead of using a DHP overnight, use a chi and just produce air heat. You don't need a basking spot overnight. Have a bit of a nice air heat, a nice ambient temp overnight of about 24, and you're sorted. Be open to change. But the one thing that annoys me is don't take everything you see as gospel because it gets misconstrued.
It's the same as with regards to translucent purins again, because it is still a relatively weak gene. Even visual to het is a risk unless you really know that they are not related and there's a wide berth between genetics. So you still have the possibility of having some issues if you know that there's a chance of relatives kind of thing. So if I try to do a trans to het purin, I have to know without a doubt that they are not closely related in any way, shape or form. So it's still a risk in a way, unless you really know where your dragons are coming from kind of thing. And you've got a lot of in-depth genetic knowledge with regards of the lineage. So it's still a risk. So with the Phantom Leather, now this one is Tracy Saltmarsh's own line. It's a recessive form of leatherback and it was first produced in 2004 by Phantom Dragons. The animals are smooth dorsolaterally with almost normal scalation over the rest of the body. So when bred together, they don't produce silkback dragons. The entire clutch is a visual phantom leather. It works like any other recessive genetic heritability-wise. When you have an animal that expresses the incomplete dominant leather and a phantom leather, it's a true micro-leather animal. They're extremely smooth, and between that of a silkback and a really smooth incomplete dominant leather. So that's the Phantom Dragon's phantom leather. So there's the Dunner, that's a dominant genetic that popped out and it was propagated by Kevin Dunner of Dragon's Den. The Dunner has got nothing to do with colour or pattern and everything to do with scale shape and arrangement on the animal. So the scales are more conical in shape. For those who don't know what that means, it's like circular and they don't lay flat in one direction on the animal. So the scales are sort of haphazardly arranged, you know, especially on the stomach and under the beard as well. The scale shape and arrangement causes the pattern to express differently in those types of animals, but you can have a patternless zero whiplets Dunner. So yeah, it's quite a cool one actually, but if bred incorrectly, they do have the problems. So they have problems with being able to take a deep breath, and that's what Helios had the issue with. And Dunners are renowned for storing food in the throat, so they'll leave it there for a while before they decide to swallow it properly. That just seems to be a Dunner trait overall. But I think overall, they're actually really quite a strong gene, if bred correctly. So a zero is a recessive masking genetic that masks colour and pattern in the animal, resulting in a silver-grey colour. If you add hypo to that, you'll get a white animal. If you add trans to that, you'll get a purple-grey zero. And if you add both hypo and trans, you'll get a lavender-purple-coloured zero, which is quite nice, really? Actually. Yeah, it's cool how hypo and trans can affect the colouring.
The white ones are my favourite. I've always wanted a white one.
We've created ones that are 100% het for hypo, and there's a possibility they're het for trans, but they're also 66% het for zero, and that's because both the parents was 100% het zeros. So they'll pretty much be a silver grey colour.
I love those kiddos.
They are quite cute, aren't
they? Your holdback. Isn't he a spicy nugget?
He's lovely, isn't he? The other one's whiplets. That's a recessive masking genetic that masks the pattern and mutes the colour. So usually when you see a whiplets, they're actually like a dusty pinky yellow colour, which is very, very pretty, but it does mute the colour. So they almost look dusty or pastely. They're quite nice. I quite like them. I've not got one myself. I won't be breeding them or anything like that. I probably won't breed zeros again, actually. I'll just focus on my main projects, which are Arisia and me reds and stuff.
Oh, so your reds.
I'll have some.
What is your favourite more?
I like the Hypo just because I know it's basically one of the bog standard morphs that came about quite a while ago. But the reason I like it is because it reduces the dark pigment in the animal. So you can end up with brighter colours from it. And I just really like how it affects the colour on the animal. Although saying that, these that we produce now, they're coming through with really cool copper brown colours on, you know, some of the dunners. And I'm so tempted by one of the males, and I just keep saying, nope.
Do it.
He's so nice. He's like a copper. He's just like a copper bearded dragon. It's you know, like the colour of a penny.
Do it. You'd have a new line of copper beardies.
It is really nice. So, but I do really like me red. So anything that's got red in, blue in, I love those colour phases and stuff like that. But as an actual morph, it has to be the recessive morph, which is the Hypo.
I definitely need a red beardie to go with my red cresties and my red gargs.
Well, I'll be purring Arisia at the beginning of next year to Yondu.
Oh, Yondu.
He's much more red than his dad is, because his dad's more tangerine and obviously his mum's a coral red. So I would expect them to have, in fact, they're going to have massive babies because Arisia is bigger than he is and pretty much fully grown now. So
that's going to be great. I'm excited for those babies.
Yeah, she's.
I love your red baby.
Got, she's quite pastely in colour, so she's like pastel yellow and red. And she's got really nice blue bars. And because he's not coral red, photos can be deceiving because they make him look a bit more orangey, but he's not. He's actually red.
Don't even talk about trying to get red on camera.
I think they'll have some really nice babies because I held him back because he had such prominent blue bars. And she's got even more prominent blue bars than he has. So I would expect them. She's also a genetic stripe. I know it's called a genetic stripe and it's a line bred pattern phase, but that's just the name of
just what it is.
She is one of them. So she will produce some babies with stripes, which will be nice. And just as a note to most people, Wero is not a morph. It's just a combination of Whitblitz and Zero together. Silverback, it's an interesting one. It's a recessive genetic and it's extremely limited in the obby because of scams. Tracy Saltmarsh doesn't know anyone else with the genetic besides herself at Phantom Dragons, but it takes about 6 months for the animal to show the trait. The gene actually causes the animal to slowly lose pattern and colour, resulting in a sort of silver-grey animal. To be honest, it doesn't really matter for us in the UK because we don't have them here anyway and they're not readily available to anyone else either. So it's just a bit of information. Just a very quick note on albinism. A number of years back, it did pop up in a group of animals in Australia, but they weren't able to ever stabilise it, so it disappeared. So it doesn't really exist anymore in the hobby, although I did see a photo recently which looked like there was two albino dragons. If that's the case, I can't see that they'll be able to stabilise it enough to make it work. And unfortunately, if it was a real photograph, then the babies probably won't live very long. But anyway, when purring recessive genes other than Hypo, as that's quite a predominantly strong gene now, I would always say it's best to pur het rather than visual to visual or visual to het, but that's only because the genes are still weak in the grand scheme of things. And, you know, translucent to het, as I was just saying, it's okay in some circumstances if you know that the lines are not closely related and that you're able to continue strengthening a line. But predominantly, I would suggest it's always het to het. It's the same with colour mutations. Lines shouldn't be continually closely bred just to bring out the most insane colours, you know, that's possible. But they are. People are still breeding closely related lines just to bring out insane colours. So as an example, only a small fraction of a clutch will have, say, one or two of the colour you actually want to work with. So it's the same as if you chose one from a clutch of intense reds that wasn't the brightest. It could also produce intense reds.
Mm.
So that is why it is called selective breeding. It's the way forward to further the structure as well as the, you know, as well as strengthen the genetic. Bearded dragon genetics are really interesting, and it's good to know when you are planning on breeding what exactly you're working with and what each gene is, because a lot of what people class as morphs aren't really morphs, the colour phases, pattern phases, that kind of thing. So yeah, I think it's good to chat around what genetics really are. Let's do some questions then.
So we have, what's the most incorrect thing you've ever heard about beardies?
Okay, so there's a few. The first one would be dragons require a heat mat overnight. They don't. A nice room ambient temp is good enough for them. As long as it doesn't drop below 16 degrees prolonged periods, your dragon will be just fine. Another one would be dragons can't see the colour red. Dragons can. They're a diurnal species with full cone receptors. That means they can pick up on light and ultraviolet light that not even our eye can pick up on. They can see it. My dragon's cuddling me. My dragon must be my dragon must be happy because it fell asleep on me. I think this is where misinformation comes into play. We humanize animals too much. The reality of that one is your dragon is asleep on you because it's out of its controlled environment during the day and it's cold. They associate lower temp drops as nighttime.
Mm.
So they automatically go off to sleep to conserve energy, because in the wild, they would not be being fed every day. We'd be having to hunt for it and whatnot. So
they are spoiled.
Yes, they're very spoiled. Your dragon needs to be fed every day. That's another one. They don't. In fact, they're designed to go extended periods of time without both food and water. So all we're essentially doing by feeding them every day is creating lazy, obese animals, which is detrimental to them. Like, I know people find it cute, or look at the chunky animal. Mm. But when you sit and you think about it logically, you are causing an excess fat buildup, which is then in turn crushing internal organs.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, so be realistic. Yes, it's funny and cute, but it's also really bad, because the bigger a dragon gets, the less active they become, because they don't need to move around and stuff like that. They know they're going to get fed repeatedly. It's like with hand feeding. Dragons will become very reliant on being hand fed. If you hand feed your dragon, it's just going to sit there and wait for you to feed it.
Mm.
Because it knows you will. So yeah, they're the biggest incorrect misinformation I've heard. Probably more, but...
So we have two questions left. Someone wanted to know, how do you clean clogged femoral pores, and what are the struggles of said job?
Right, so basically, if you have clogged femoral pores, the reality is you don't have enough inside that viv for your dragon to naturally clean them himself. I know females have femoral pores, but the clogged femoral pores is usually a male thing. I know a lot of people advise, oh, get a toothbrush and squeeze them out and watch people on YouTube doing it. Don't do that. Don't do that. Like, there is a high chance you're not a professional. You are not a vet. There is a chance you're going to hurt and damage your dragon. My advice would be, if it's incredibly clogged, give them a soak. Mm. After that, add more bark and branches and stuff. Rough edges, but not sharp.
Oh,
yeah, some rough stuff. So when it's naturally moving, and when they naturally shed, they rub on stuff. Like, we'll watch the dragons when they're about to shed. They'll start scraping the head on things. They'll scratch their own bark. You know, they'll whip the tail on things. Give them stuff they can, like a human hairbrush.
Mm.
So when we need to detangle our hair, we use a brush. Give your dragon the natural things that it would use in the wild to keep itself healthy, because they know what they're doing. It's just when they're not given the tools.
They can't do what they don't have.
Exactly. So yeah, femoral pores usually is a sign that it's not got something adequate enough for it to keep them clear. Give it a soak, let it get a bit softer, and then give it some cork box, something it can rub on, and please don't squeeze them. That's the only thing I can say. Please don't try and remove them yourself.
Mm.
If you're concerned, take them to the vets. The vets know what they're doing. An exotic vet will know how to remedy the problem. Please don't. I know I've seen so many people recommending, oh, this YouTube video, it shows you how to squeeze them and stuff. Please don't. But I have seen lots of vets say, oh, this is what a fun part of the job. I enjoy doing this. You know, like, poppers and stuff. I have actually seen exotic vets say, yep, we enjoy this. It's satisfying to unclog it. So please take it to the vet. They'll probably be more than happy to assist you with that.
Mm. Final question is, how did you guys get into breeding, or what prompted you to get into breeding or want to breed?
I will leave this one to Stacey. I don't breed. Stacey is the mastermind, knows things like the back of her hand. So
I wanted to get into breeding because I always used to spend a lot of time going in the local reptile shop, and you could never really handle any of the geckos and the dragons because they just weren't handleable at all. They didn't want to be in your hands. They wanted to jump back out. And I just thought, I'd love to create healthy reptile that I can say to people, oh yeah, these, you know, you can pick these up, you know, without fear of being bitten or anything like that, or them jumping out your hand or that kind of thing, and
thinking they can fly.
Yeah, and because of reading all the genetic side of things, which really interested me, I wanted to do very, very small scale selective breeding. So you'll know yourself because I've told you before, but I only pair one dragon a year, and it's always within what I'm. So in my head, I only pair one dragon a year, but in my head, I've got the next 6 years planned out for one dragon per year. And that's to further my own projects each time. If a female who I had planned to pair doesn't look ready or anything like that, then that's fine. It just doesn't happen. It's no big deal to me because first and foremost, they're my pets. I'd rather them be healthy and happy than force anything on them that the body wouldn't be ready for.
A lot of people forget that, don't they?
Yeah, and the most important thing to me is, I know that you can breed dragons from 18 months old and that kind of thing, but I like them to be over 2 years old so that they really are, they've got the stockiness, because even females are quite stocky. They've got the fat reserves behind them, they've got the growth behind them, they just look more capable of handling a breeding season than what a dragon under 2 years old looks. And that's just personal preference. People can breed younger than that. People do breed younger than that. But I prefer to breed over 2 years old with female dragons and over 1 year old with male dragons, preferably actually more 18 months old. Whenever I tend to do a pairing, the male is usually around 18 months old at the time. So I got into breeding because I wanted to produce not just good quality animals, but animals that are handleable for me, and now that I've had kids, for my children as well, so that they can enjoy them. I wanted to produce stuff that I could keep back myself and enjoy without worrying that they was going to jump off and hurt themselves. I work a lot on the personality side of things when I breed animals. I only really breed for what I feel I can manage with having two small young children as well, still enjoy doing, because when it stops being an enjoyment, then it's not really a hobby. So I feel like I can give more of my time to a smaller amount of quality reptiles than I can to a huge, huge amount of reptiles, because my circumstances differ to the next person. Someone else might be able to manage that level of reptiles. I personally couldn't, and I don't want to, because I just feel like I couldn't spend as much time as I wanted with each reptile if I had that level of reptiles. So for me, it's all about providing quality genetics and knowing exactly what goes into that animal and being able to say to someone, yeah, I know exactly what's in that animal. And there's no sort of falsifying anything. There's no, you know, hiding anything. It's all just completely transparent, completely honest. This was the pairing. This is the parents. This is what's in your animal that I've just given you. And that for me is worth more than any type of mass breeding. So yeah, that's what I got into it. And also because I just love reptiles and babies. I think that's it for the questions, isn't it?
Yeah, that was all the questions.
I think this podcast, I've had a couple people message looking forward to the informative, in-depth podcast. Like, I've had a couple people quite excited for those, like this one, for instance, and obviously the Leo one we have coming up, probably a Cresty one, you know, Tortoise, you know, all those sort of things that we all have experience with.
Thanks to everyone that submitted questions. That was the last one. I'll be uploading the new Bearded Dragon curse sheet to the files on Reptile Intelligence UK. So alongside the curse sheet that's going up, there's also already a sheet on Bearded Dragon safe fruits and vegetables. So that is also on the files on Reptile Intelligence UK.
So we would like to say a massive thank you to Stacey for sharing her wonderful knowledge with us today on beardies. We hope you found that really interesting as we did. Me personally found it very, very informative because obviously I don't keep beardies, but I do want to. I want like 10. No, that's a lie. I don't actually want 10. It was also a lie. I would so have 10 if I had the space. Maybe I have 11. No, that's an odd number. That feels weird. Thank you for listening. We hope you have a wonderful rest of your day, evening, afternoon, whenever you decide to listen. And we will see you next week for The Leo Life with a special guest. Very special guest. We're very excited to have her on. We have Chloe's Geckos UK. We will be having her coming on next week to talk all things Leos, all things projects. And I am super excited to hear all about her amazing project. If you're a Leo lover and you want to hear about some really cool Leos from a really cool person, I definitely look out for next week's podcast.
So thanks again for listening. Thanks again for all your support. And we are looking forward to having another chat with you next week. Toodles.
Bye.
Bye.